Hey everyone, this is part two of my interview with the head SOM wine manager, beverage manager of the National Club, Brian Perry. And the National Club, I don't think I mentioned it, we talked about it in the interview, but a reminder, one of the largest sellers in all of Canada. And the reason I joined the National Club was because of wine, and Brian was a huge part of it. So we ended part one with me talking about how cool it was to be called Sir, and only cool in a novelty sort of way. Part two, it's going to start with like nerdy wine talk and Chardonnay talk and all this other stuff, and then get back into Brian and the club and 100 other things. I know I briefly mentioned it in part one, but a shout out again to Isabel Clendenin from Au Bon Clément. She was a guest of mine in episode 119 when the winery came actually to the National Club and we tried their wines. If you can find them, their Chardonnays and Pinots are incredible. As is the second part of this interview, but again, a reminder, an apology that the audio quality isn't the best. Issues with the room, mic placement, it's on me. I got to be more aggressive about how telling people how to hold the mic and all that sort of jazz. But I cleaned it up as well as I can. You'll be able to get 99% of what is being said. And this is a very important, very special interview with me, with one of the most important people in my wine life, Brian Perry. But I feel like I've said that like 1,700 times. So we'll move on. Again, shout out to everyone for listening, everyone who's recommending the wine podcast for others. I know there's lots of different wine podcasts out there, so I appreciate you taking time to listen to mine. So for the final time, rate, subscribe, review, all that sort of jazz. But here it is, part two of my interview from the National Club, Brian Perry.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Getting nerdy wine again for a second, because we're just going to bounce around this interview. By the way, what are we drinking? We're drinking the Au Bon Clément. This is a beautiful California producer. This is, I think, their single bottle or single vineyard, 2014 Chardonnay. I've had members of Au Bon Clément on this podcast way earlier. This wine's just drinking. Like, you know what? All right, now off topic. I just never understand when someone says, I can't drink Chardonnay. I'm like, do you realize how many expressions there are of this incredible grape?
Well, it's probably because their initial tasting of a Chardonnay was garbage. You know, so people set prejudice very quickly on wine. I don't drink Chardonnay. Well, you know, I'll have a glass of Chablis.
Yeah.
It's happened to me 1,000 times, and I'm sure it's happened to you in your household circle. But, you know, it's people who really haven't gotten past other than the title of the varietal.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much the taste or description of the varietal. So I generally take that with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
And try to fool them into tasting. And, you know, sometimes some of the inexpensive ones that are over-oaked, and we don't mean barrel, you know, can sometimes be incredibly glowing on the mouth. And
people, oh, yeah.
So I get where that comes from. I'm just not sure that I condone it, but I get where it comes from.
Oh, yeah, no, I get it as well. Then I'm like, all right, you want any Chardonnay? More Montrachet for me. I'll see you later.
Oh, that'll be fine.
Yeah. I'll have another glass of that. I wonder, this club and maybe other private clubs, I wonder how many of them are going to start to look more at alternatives from Burgundy. Because when we talk about the prices of things going up, nothing's gone up more than Burgundy, I think, over the last 25-30 years.
You know, I'm no longer buying here, so I'm speaking from past, but I worked with Jeremy now for 2 years, and Jeremy is the now beverage manager at Head Sommelier, and with great experience. All sommeliers want Burgundy in their cellar.
Of course.
And, you know, again, you have to sort of, getting back to my original subject is, you know, don't buy for your own taste and buy for the taste of others. I don't think anyone argues the quality of Burgundy wines. The argument would be in the pricing of them.
Yeah.
To your question, that would be his to answer. If I were his age and his shoes now, yes, without a doubt I would.
So then what I wonder about, will that lead to clubs like the National Club or a lot of other ones where they look at Central Otago, Tasmania, Prince Edward County, Niagara? Like, I know we're already doing it with Oregon Pinots, which are, you know, cheaper, but I wonder if it'll lead to a greater investment in some of those other areas, because I've certainly tried plenty from Otago and from Niagara and the Bench and Prince Edward County. I'm like, okay, this might not be the highest end, but I'm like, this tastes like an incredibly well-made Village or even a pretty damn good Premier Cru. I wonder if we could see more of that from clubs.
I can only speak for this one. I think you will see it from a lot of clubs, depending on who's wanting their wine program. But I think, you know, Jeremy will go that way simply out of necessity. The problem being is, if you know, if your cellar, getting back to the historical cellars, is if your cellar is built on those kind of wines. So if the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir from France that you tasted at the National Club, you know, was a Montrachet or Meursault or, you know, one of the better Burgundy wines. You know, I'm not sure it's an alternative. I think it's a direction in taste. Mm-hmm. Your list would have to portray that.
Right.
For what I said right now, I'm not sure how I would do that.
Mm-hmm.
I have too much depth of the old one, so I would make excuses for it.
Right.
Personally, I mean that in due respect of all of the wines you mentioned.
Yeah, of course.
That's, I think, would be my approach.
Mm-hmm.
That goes to show you my age. But I think Jeremy will take a more progressive view of that. Certainly, he's way open to that.
Yeah, for me, it's not even progressive. It's just about price. About, like, because trust me, if I can just drink Burgundy all the time, I'm going to be the happiest.
Well, not too many can.
No, exactly. I'm going to be the happiest person. I guess it just comes down to you just drink less Burgundy, and then you have to find other alternatives that are at least close to what Burgundy can provide.
I mean, you know, if you look at a wine like this, which is probably close to Burgundy in price, you know, certainly would stand mm-hmm. for anyone. There would be obvious prejudice for people who have Burgundy in taste, but, you know, this is a remarkably well-made Chardonnay. I didn't have to do that in my time.
Yeah.
It's a powerful question. I hope when you sit down to interview Jeremy, you bring that into the picture. Right now, he's been buying some Burgundy. He, like every someone I ever met, loves it.
Of course.
So he's, you know, doing the best he can. And it's, you know, when your budget is such and such a dollars, you need to fill in this such and such an area. Burgundy probably is going to be the first one.
Yeah.
But he has been buying. And, you know, within our club, as you know, that we do a sort of a wine catalog here once a year and have done that since 09, I did it long before that on a one-page sheet. But sort of buying some of these things, and probably the excuse of buying some of these things that there would be remnants after the sale would go into our cellar. So my method in the madness of generally offering Burgundies in those offerings were to buy 15 cases of, which we knew at least 10 or 12 would.
Oh, yeah.
The other three cases could be mixed, especially if they were varietal offerings, in the sense of vintage offers. So could back into our cellar without having to spend $25,000 on three cases of Burgundy. So that was my way of sort of skirting it, but it is coming to that, and I agree with you. So yes, to your question, I think most definitely they will have to. I'm not sure who has a budget to continue on with Burgundy.
How good does it feel for you knowing the impact you've had? Like you've had, as I said, a massive impact on me and my own wine tastes, and helping with trips. You mentioned Scavino. I got to do a private tour of Scavino through you and through the National Club. And, you know, at any wine event I'm at, at some point someone's going to say, oh yeah, we saw Corsini and Chianti, or we were here, we were there. And a lot of them was trips that you helped, you know, you helped at least place the first phone call. How good does it feel knowing, like, you've had a massive impact on the palates of so many people?
Well, certainly, probably the travels, hopefully. I you know, to that note, when Prince Corsini was here for his last visit, which was September, I believe, of this year, we kind of asked for a show of hands in the 100 people in the room, how many people had visited, and 34 people put up.
That's crazy.
And so that, you know, gives you, that's not always the case for all of the wineries, but we have, you know, in the case of Bordeaux, we've sent countless people to Chateau Palmer, including yourself,
including myself,
to the wonderful visits to Gigal, who's always been more than us.
Been a Gigal as well.
So, you know, we've been able to do that, and I think basically it was just something I took on. I felt it was kind of, whenever I travel to, I think my whole enlightenment in the wine industry has been travel. I mean, we can sit down and talk about wine all day, and we're basically a couple of guys discussing a glass.
Yeah.
But when you're walking in the vineyards and you're talking to people whose family, in most French cases, have been three generations long, in Corsini's case, five generations long, you know, there's suddenly a depth of everything from, you know, the vinification to the actual family doing the vine. And I tell people all the time, you know, if you have any spare money, go and walk the land. Go and drink a glass with them, if you can get that.
Yeah.
So, you know, fortunately, most of the members here, you know, a cost is generally not a hindrance for them to travel. So I started taking it upon myself to do that. It engulfed a fair amount of my time, but I enjoyed it. And I enjoyed the after effects of it, because they would always say to me, you know, I had a wonderful trip. And, you know, I will remote to that. I just had shared this story with someone a week ago. You know, Corsini got really popular because so many people visit Tuscany, of course, in Florence. And his winery, as you know, was 20 minutes from Florence, so it fits a lot of things. But Gianluca, who is his really his man there on the ground, a personal friend of me for many years. So I would call him and say, oh, Matt Goss is coming and his girlfriend or his wife or blah, blah, blah. And they would go, okay, what time and when and what? And, you know, you always know this is a bit of a hindrance to them, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
But his last statement was always, is it going to be painful?
Right.
I think I remember sharing this with you.
Yes.
Because we know, and I mean this in total respect, because I've been in that category. People just come and say, is this Cabernet Sauvignon?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm visiting a winery. Let's get as many picks as we can. And so they really don't want to do that. And so I remember, not so much in the Bordelais just assume, I think in when I was sending you for a visiting Egal, I mentioned to Stefan, I think, who was the cellar master there, still is, that, you know, you were quite savvy with wine. He said, oh, great, great, great.
Yeah.
So, it saves them a lot of sort of educational work.
Yeah, and also, like, there's, you know, I'm low maintenance.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
You know, just come and we appreciate the time. Show me whatever you can show me. If you're busy, I totally get it. You know, actually, I remember we went to Gugal. That was a great timing because they had opened all these Lala wines.
Oh, that's a terrible thing.
The day before, and they had all this excess Lala wines that had been opened and were still in bottles. So that was a good day. It's funny when I think of, and I don't know what your favorite wines are now. I mean, you were mentioning Brunello, but I think most Somms. It's always going to be Burgundy. It's going to be Riesling, usually more old world, like Germany. And it's going to be Northern Rhone Syrah. Those are the three I find.
You got me on Northern Rhone, for sure. And I pretty well think in the hands of Rote Gigel is my favorite. The wines of Chapoté Ogier, I get all of that. I just think that this is pretty distinctive thing about Gigal's rotis. But Burgundy, appreciated, but not in my corner as much as it should be. So I would probably give Bordeaux over Burgundy because I like everything about it. Both banks, I like the style, I like the wine, I like the history. The wine just makes a little more sense to me and my palate. I know I'll be regaled for this, but Riesling is perfectly fine. Any Moselle, any Riesling from Germany works for me. Some Alsatian too. Pray tell, I purchased it, sadly, for this building from all over the world. Some Canadian, of course, but I purchased from Australia, which I'm sure is going to send you to bed. just simply because it was a varietal that always made sense to me, and it never made sense to me that it didn't make sense to anyone else.
Yes.
And that was the hardest pitch I've had in this building. I thought, oh my, and our food lent to it, especially in the early years. We had gelled meats. We had, you know, we had things that just made total sense.
Yeah.
And, oh no. And I discovered, back to my point, that I think people of that era, the reason that was available in Canada, and to a certain extent still is available in Canada, was absolute rubbish. You know, i.e. Black Tower, i.e. whatever it was on the shelves in those days, and it's still on the shelves. So I think people just, if they cut their teeth on a bad particular wine or varietal, they think that pretty well represents it worldwide. But it was a hard sell here. In fact, you ended up being the purchaser of most of those wines.
I remember
fully.
Yes. Oh, I remember many, many years ago. I forget birthdays, but I never forget this. Just having lunch one day, and there was, you know, some like 15-year-old Rheingau Riesling. And it was like $50. I'm like, what? I'm like, okay, I'm gonna just take that bottle because I could just take the rest home. And then slowly over time,
yeah.
And yes, you had an Eden, or was it a Clare Valley Australian Riesling?
Yeah, I remember the name of that house.
Oh,
it was
so
really quite good, actually. It was,
oh,
really
my
quite good.
God.
Last place in the world you'd probably put your finger on for Riesling, but it was quite good. But anyway, that varietal has been my thorn inside,
mm-hmm.
in the sense of, fortunately, we've been able to sell off what stayed too long, never too long, but stayed longer than I probably wanted it to. But it was the hardest sell for sure.
And by the way, I agree with you with the Bordeaux. And I think the special thing about Bordeaux is you can even find something, and not that $30 is cheap, it's not. But you can find $25 to $30 bottle of Bordeaux that, as you said, that makes sense, that tastes like Bordeaux. Just a little bit of the earthy mushroom, the dark fruit, that it's just there. There's this, it's this nice warm hug of a wine.
Yeah, that no other country does it as well.
Yeah.
We can argue all day about it. Anyone can argue with me about that.
Yeah.
No other country does it as well. And it's a combination of 100 things. But without getting into specifics, you can, you know. It's funny because, you know, I remember visiting, as you did, Chateau Margaux, and we lucked out in Margaux, as you did in
Gugel,
because they had a trade tasting that day, and we get in at 4 o'clock, which I learned to believe is the best time to show up at these things. And you know, she was such a cordial girl, but she ended up, you know, corking 4 or 5 bottles that we tasted and saying, you know, this is Chateau Margaux. But you know, the interesting part of that, we're having a conversation, and you know, the town of Margaux was horrible. There's not a restaurant in one, I think, that's owned by a Parisian.
It's so true. I was there in September. There's so nothing there.
I kind of anticipated a little, not as much cosmopolitan, a little more charm. Mm-hmm. And it was not. But anyway, certainly what surrounds it is. But anyway, she's listing off to me as we're just having a conversation and, you know, the tasting is done and we're just chatting. And she's telling me about these, you know, 5th, 6th growths that in France are selling for $25 or say €20. She was saying, you know, they have to be picked up by negotiators and get out into the world. And I can't remember the wine. So when I'm after leaving Bordeaux, I went to Paris, which I always do. And I went to a cafe, and that waiter, after serving me a chapotier, I said, do you have such and such a wine? I can't remember the title. He said, in fact, we do.
Ah.
And it may have been, I remember the year, it would have been about an 8-year-old version of it. And I said, oh my God, this wine is remarkable. Now, sometimes, you know, you pick up on the ambiance of where you are, because I always find drinking Chianti in Tuscany is much better than drinking in downtown Toronto.
That is true.
But it's still, wine is wine. And, you know, it never forgot me. So many of the wines that are here, we bought through Negociant, so Chasplein, which is really, you know, a top-end 5th. But some wines, just today we opened for somebody upstairs, the Latour Matelec 2005, which is on our list for $150. You know, and this wine is drinking absolutely stunning. If you put a paper bag around this and said this is a 3rd growth, it would take a pretty skilled palate to say it isn't. So the point of all that is that we did jump on that bandwagon, especially for the 2000 and 2005 vintages. They're almost all gone out of our cellar, sadly. But, you know, these wines piggybacked on our Palmer orders, because the Palmer Renegotiant family still are, Seychelles. So we were able to say, buy, you know, I'm going to use round numbers here, $100,000 worth of Palmer. And then they would say, well, we'll tap on $20,000. And it was sight on scene.
Perfect.
And you'd get these wonderful surprises like Christmas morning.
Yeah.
you know, of a 5th growth that was remarkably well made. And never 1 year old. You know, at least 4 years on the wine by the time you got it. So as I said, we're sitting down on 05s now, no 2000s left, but those wines on our list are a bargain, on anyone's list are a bargain. In this restaurant in Paris, this wine was about €60.
Note to self, after we're done, I'm going to probably have dinner here. I'm going to have one of those.
Yeah.
I'm going to definitely.
You need to try it because it's an exceptional wine.
Do you remember, do you have any stories, and we don't have to give specifics of events, dates, or people, but like some of the craziest moments here? Because the funny thing about this place is, and people need to see that Brian is now laughing, is so many of these wine events, they start in black tie, and they're beautiful, and the wine and the food and the service, this is full black tie affair event. And then at the end of the night, everyone spills up to the rooftop because no one wants to go home and everyone wants to keep drinking. And that's, I think, for the staff of the National Club, always the hardest. Yeah. The 90 minutes, or not hard, hardest, challenging, or you're burning the most calories.
Yeah, exactly.
How about we go with that? You're burning the most calories the 90 minutes after a wine event is done. Is there any that sort of sticks out
many
for you?
Yeah. To date, I've stopped counting, but I've done 100 dinners here and at least 70 of serious magnitude. Not that they're not all worthy. Probably my most memorable of ones that we've created out of our cellar, you know, like a Burgundy night of opening, you know, Richebourg and Chateaux, and that was part of the dinner. That was the appetizer course.
Yep.
Chateau Palmer, since it has been our favorite, you know, I more or less inherited that favoritism when I took over this job, and so we've always bought it. It's been our Bordeaux go-to, not that it's a bad thing. So we had a good deal of depth in the cellar. We would do Palmer dinners, of which you were a part of,
mm-hmm.
a couple of them, from, you know, starting at the 75 or 72 vintage, I can't remember, and going up to whatever the current year was to drink it. But, you know, what happens in most cases here, and, you know, we're always extravagant, and it's not an intentional thing, and it's a very difficult thing to pull off at dinner. Because it's members, and getting back to my original point, they are your bosses, they own that cellar. And so you can't do this. You need to pour, you need to have a flow of the evening. That flow sometimes ends up in people being way too happy.
Yes.
And to your point of the after hours, sometimes before we hit the rooftop, it would be an alternative room from the dining room.
Yep.
Now, from a personal point of view, that has been really good for me because I've been able to sit down and drink with very interesting, remarkable people. That wasn't part of my job description, although never really forbidden, just never spoken. And, you know, you would sit down and drink and, you know, you and I have been part of some of these together. You know, you'd be sitting down and opening, you know, four bottles of Chateau Palmer at quarter to one in the morning. And, you know, and I think maybe I should put this down somewhere. This has to be a memorable a thing. But they happen quite repeatedly. So, yeah, nothing had ever got rowdy. But, yes, that you'd end up, you know, leaving the place at 2 or 3 in the morning.
Yeah, the next day was a tough day.
Very tough day. And in getting back to that is I was alone in the job, so I had to show up. And it was very... But, you know, in the heat of the moment, do you say no to a vertical of Palmer?
No, it's worth it. It's always worth it. Yeah, it's always worth it. And I think all the guests are always thankful. Like you say, extravagant, and people can think the word extravagance bad, but...
No, within the boundaries of...
Yeah.
It's a, you know, you have a dinner. Sometimes, you know, people put together why... I get why they do it. You know, LCBO do dinners. We know various people that do it without mentioning their names. You know, agencies and brokers for wine. They need to make money, as we do, in the sense of we have to at least break even on this. So, but what happens is, you know, our members come to this. This is not a learning experience. This is a social experience.
Yeah.
They're going to socialize. The learning experience is something that may come as an after effect or not. But the point is they get to taste some wines, which they feel they've earned. They own that cellar. You know, we don't be clinical in the sense of pouring 1.5 ounces. And so...
Always good wrists here.
Always good wrists.
Yeah. But
an Irish wrist.
Yeah.
So, you know, the reality is that, you know, it turns out never have we ever seemed to have lost control in any event.
Oh, God, no.
But they've been some very interesting nights for me here. But if I have to get it more specific, I'll go to jail.
Nope, that's fine. I'll always remember my worst one. And
well, I think it was also your best one.
Yeah, the Burgundy. Yeah, I still remember that. And I had to do the morning show the next day.
Yeah.
That was a tough one. But also, to me, what I always loved about the wine events here is I would always have this moment of feeling thankful. Like I remember the last black tie affair, and there's an old glass of Tom Eddy Cabernet Sauvignon. And there is a Gugel, and then next to that there's Chateau Palmer. And I remember just staring at these three glasses. The value, like you guys don't make money on these events. The idea is to break even or maybe make a dollar, but just having the opportunity to try these wines that if I had to do it outside these four walls, it would cost me five times the price, and they might not have some of these old vintages. It's one of the coolest things, and that I always felt this honor that I was able to enjoy these wines that are rare and hard to get.
And I felt it an honor to be able to purchase them to do that.
Yeah.
You know, that event was sort of a showcase for our 150th anniversary, which, as you know, is happening this year, 2024. And we did, you know, sort of an idea of who were our favorite winemakers to put into a trio box to mark that sort of anniversary of the club and the cellar. And the sort of mandate that we had was, you know, they had to be through the club. They had to have met the members. Now, you know, because it's endless where you could go here, but, you know, Seychelles has been here more times, I think, than I have. Tom Eddy has been a longtime favorite here. Masterful Napa speaker. And, you know, Gigal goes without mention. So it came down to after we eliminated people, and also who would provide us 300 bottles of a particular vintage.
Yes.
You know, so I had the good fortune of visiting Gigal, as you did, to sort of close the deal on Nampuy, which turned into be a wonderful day of tasting wines. And Bill, we also did a Scotch from Highland Park. We bought our own cask, which is a really complex thing to do. Anyway, we did, so we bottled a cask strength Scotch in homage of the 150th. Bill went to Scotland to sort of get a look at that in the barrel. So once they bottled it, it's all in tow now. So those three combinations, the interesting part of that conversation you're having with me, is that Jamie Chazelle was at your table. And Jamie's a Bordelaise born and raised. And I was very interested, without ever asking him, to sort of see which wine. One was his, he grew up with, and one he knows very well. You know, it's a right bank or a left bank wine. So the Rhone wine was there. Everyone knows who Gigal is. Certainly everyone in France knows who Gigal is. Interestingly, Tom Eddy's Cabernet was there. And I've yet to meet too many Frenchmen that don't have a particular opinion about Napa wines.
Yes, a very specific opinion that's not always positive.
I'm being as kind as I can here. But anyway, so I waited my time and I sort of said to him, you know, Philippe's wines, you know, his father created these wines and all he has to do is steer them as I do, you know, to be what they are. And he's absolutely right. So I said, what do you think of the American? I don't know this wine, Brian, but you know, this wine is very well made.
Wow.
So I thought to myself, you know, I never really contacted Tom afterwards about it. I should have. Things just got busy, and you know how that happens. I hope to talk to Tom that he will come this year to a dinner in one of the events over the year. But I'm not sure how flattered Tom would be about that, but I think if I were, I would be. And I think it was just, you know, basically it's sort of, it's nice product. I've heard those words 100 times. So, you know, he said, no, the wine has great integrity, great balance. So I think he was a little surprised. And now, obviously, he drank more of the French, both French, than the American. But the very fact that he opened a discussion to it, and it wasn't just, you know...
He wasn't just being polite. He had professional respect for what was in the glass.
Politeness is not in the Bordelaise.
It, you know, it's often in short supply. What do you like? What's your, and you might not have a full plan. What is your plan? Because I know you're slowly easing into retirement, rightfully so, as you've been here for getting close to 30 years.
Yeah. Well, it's slow tuned. I will stay a little bit to celebrate this anniversary. We're still in sort of discussion about that.
Yep.
I will do much more travel. Will I work in wine? No. You know, I feel that, you know, I hate to say my time has come and gone, but I think that my representation in the industry, which has been in this building only, has, I've done the best I could, worked really hard at it, feel I've accomplished, you know, quite a bit. I think now just to enjoy wine as the guy next door, mm-hmm. and travel. So take on all of those people that said, come and visit us, and do that. So I have a partner that likes to travel, thankfully, which is a major part of the game. So we have done a lot of travel, and we will continue to do that. So it's a pretty short sight. I will still be here. That's still my decision to make. Mm-hmm. Probably a day or two a week, and when the events surface, to sort of be a man behind the scenes for the stuff we've done for the anniversary. We have a competent guy running this program right now.
Yeah, Jeremy.
You know, we have a competent guy.
Yep.
So it's not that I'm here holding anybody's hand. In fact, he's probably tolerating me. But the reality is that, you know, I feel that we do. I realize to be a sommelier beverage manager or wine program director in this building takes a fair amount of getting accustomed to, because you see the same people all the time. And so you have to nurture those relationships. And it's much more complex than being a somm in a restaurant.
Right.
That's not an easy thing to do either. So wine knowledge is one thing, but diplomacy is probably another. So, you know, and I'm not saying he lacks that, but I'm saying, you know, that's what takes time to do. And I think when you come from, as he has, from Langdon Grey Room to this sort of style, it's a little different. So the adaptation, he's done very well considering all facts.
Yeah, and I think he would agree where he's going to be a year from now, today versus a year from now. He'll learn so much more, because you mentioned diplomacy, and it's true. For you, over the years, you have to deal with people wanting a certain type of wine. Or why don't you have that wine? Or I'd like to buy all the wines. Like, well, we can't let you buy all of it because there's other members. And then like juggling the tastes of younger members versus the establishment, and then the wine committee and everything in between. Yes, your job, politics, diplomacy, it's a big part of it.
It was a major part of it. So I kind of, you know, our younger son that was here, James Bertie, who I like very much.
Yep. And now he's working in Soyuz, I believe.
Mission Hill, I think. And mm-hmm. In, I should look at this.
In Okanagan.
You know, I think he's in Penetictine with the, what's the Chardonnay house they own there? It's going to come to me. Anyway, but he went with Mission Hill as the overhaul winery. I think, you know, probably if he was listening to this, you know, he would have been a great fit as well.
Yes.
But he was younger than Jeremy and, you know, would have probably approached it a little differently. Jeremy has good experience in the sense of table experience, good knowledge of wine, great lingo on wine. So I think, you know, he's the perfect sort of appeal. James found it a little challenging sometimes to deal with.
Oh yeah, and especially when you're that young, that is hard.
That's probably exactly it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I do see a good future in this program with Jeremy because he understands wine extremely well. I mean, this guy has stodged in Michelin restaurants, and in Europe, he gets the European concept of wine, which is to me the real one. He totally understands the idea of service. He may get a little overwhelmed originally with having to do a lot. I don't think he, like me, did not have clerical background. So you're working in a somme, you simply sell the wine, and at the end of the night, you've done your deed. Here, you got to think, where is this going to be sold to? Where am I going to replace it? What am I going to replace it with? So all those thoughts are happening while everyone else has gone home. I think he's risen to that now without a doubt, but that's your initial sort of programming into this thing. I, for one, the best way I can tell you, Matt, is that, Tom Eddy once said to me, and I think it pretty well sums up my personality in this industry, not my personality of old, in this building, was, Brian, I think you're more the wizard behind the curtain than the juggler in front of the crowd. And I think that's always been the approach I've taken. It's been a little more humble, because I've always been humbled by the very fact that I'm doing this, actually. Mm-hmm.
Well, here's how I know how humble you are. And for the listeners who need to know this, I've been trying to get Brian on this for ages. And I'll pull back the curtain even more. Brian sent me an email going, yeah, we can just make it about the club. And in my head, I'm like, no, I need at least half of this interview to be about you. And I know I appreciate you doing this because I know you're not the most comfortable talking about you.
No.
So I appreciate just you being here. And also, both these things are true. All the members I've talked to are excited about Jeremy. They're excited. And I think everyone also has a sense of relief. It's like, who the hell is going to replace Brian? I'm like, Jeremy's doing a fantastic job. I've seen him host multitude Bordeaux events where he is just, and even sometimes last minute, like, oh, don't worry, I got this. It's like he was studying for hours and he had this whole speech. Like, he's great.
Absolutely.
And that's why I'm excited to have you pass the baton to him. So, but both things can be true. Everyone is super excited for him. Everyone's going to miss the shit out of you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Do you realize?
I'm
like,
not totally gone yet.
So. I know. My stepdad, was raving about you afterwards. And he's a member of Islington Golf Course, and he's been a member of clubs. He recognizes what good service looks like. And it's not like you spent the whole time with us during the Christmas buffet event. You would float in or out, for a couple minutes. But even he could recognize just how damn good you are at your job.
Well, thank you.
And we're all going to miss you. Like, and I know you're still going to be around, but I want to thank you. I mean, my waistline doesn't want to thank you. My wallet is pissed off at you so much. But my love of wine, my experience of wine, my travel, if I look at the joy that wine has brought in my life, you're a big part of that. Well, so I want to thank you.
I witnessed it in your case because the only way we differ in the sense of consumption is I'm a lover of Scotch whiskey and you are certainly are not.
Yes.
But that's our only difference in opinion on most alcoholic beverages. But I've watched you initially come here as a member evolve to now a person who has schooled yourself on wine, mm-hmm. legitimately. But not only that, very excited, host our events here. This from the guy that I met down in the Simcoe room, mm-hmm. Saying, well, I'm not so sure about what I'm going to do about this.
Yeah.
And it was basically the guy looking at how many air miles do I get for this wine, mm-hmm. to a guy now that can talk to you about Burgundy and any particular appellation within Burgundy, as an example. So I've also seen a huge evolution in you, Matt Goss. So it's, and you were my youngest member to deal with.
Yes.
Considering that the average age I dealt with was 50 plus. Now, these were seasoned people. They weren't grouchy old men. But
no.
But they were people that were used to the very best. And so it was exciting to have somebody come in and experiment mm-hmm. with what I had to offer, and usually openly, and then evolve to a person that had its own remarks, and now part of the wine committee here, which is in my days here, was a sacred position.
Oh, yeah.
So it was wonderful for me to witness that with you, too.
Thank you so much. That's it means a lot coming from you. And I, by the way, I always joke, as someone without children, getting on the wine committee will go down as one of my top three accomplishments on this planet. Well, listen, I'll end it here. I've already gone well over an hour. I'm going to break this up into two parts. But Brian, appreciate you doing this. Appreciate everything you've done for me for close to 20 years. Appreciate everything you've done for the National Club. You are one of the greatest assets this club has had since I've been a member.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on iTunes, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.